भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we are in the 8th canto, 18th chapter, and I will be doing the 13th verse.
Oh, that's what he's, is that what he got on there?
Is that on the spoon? 13th verse?
Yeah.
Thamva thamva manam drishtva mudam mana maharashyah karmani karayam asuha et suha. Excuse me, suhu. Karmani kamayam asuhu. Prasakriya Prajapatim It's on two pages, so my apologies. Tamvatam Vamanam Drishtva Modamana Maharshayaha Karmani karayam asuhu. Puraskritya prajapatim. Puraskritya prajapatim. Tamvatum vamanam drishtva modamana maharshiha karmani karayam asuhu paraskritya prajapatim Please chant. Ladies, please. Ladies, please. And just before I do the word by word, I'd just like to mention, on the third line, some of us are pronouncing it Asu, and some of us are pronouncing Asuhu. So the second is the correct. The rule that I found out was that when you see an H with a dot under it, it takes the sound of the previous vowel. So when you have an H with a dot under it, and it's preceded by an A, it's ha. When it's preceded by a U, it's hu. Okay? I didn't know that until last night. 39 years, and I've been just saying it. Hu, this, whatever it comes out. So I just thought I would clarify that. So, word by word, tum, him, vatum, the brahmachari, excuse me, vatum, the brahmachari, vamanam, dwarf, drishva, seeing, madamanaha, in a happy mood, maharishaya, the great saintly persons, karmani, ritualistic ceremonies. Kariyam asuhu. Performed. Puraskritya. Keeping in front. Prajapatim. Kashyapa Muni. The Prajapati. Translation. When the great sages saw the Lord as the brahmachari dwarf, Vamana, they were certainly very pleased. Thus they placed before them Kashyapa Muni, the Prajapati, and performed all the ritualistic ceremonies, such as the birthday ceremony. So some of us may be wondering, why is Kashyapa Muni being called a Prajapati? He's not one of the original Prajapatis. He's actually a son of one of the Prajapatis, namely, everybody remember the name? Starts with an M? Marichi?
So Marichi is actually his father, but Kashyapa Muni was given the office or the job to procreate quite a number of persons. He had 13 wives, and through those 13 wives, hundreds and hundreds of children were procreated. So from that point of view, he's considered a forefather, or a father for sure, of many progeny. Purport. According to the Vedic civilization, when a child is born in the family of a brahmana, the birthday ceremony, known as Jatakarma, is first performed, and then other ceremonies are also gradually performed. But when this Vamana Rupa, means the form of the dwarf, appeared in the form of a Vatu, or Brahmachari, his sacred thread ceremony was also performed immediately. And that's because he wasn't a little baby. He was actually a youth in a diminuated form. So I will read the English of the next several verses because of the time problem that we have. Next verse, number 14. At the sacred thread ceremony of Vamanadev, the sun god personally uttered the Gayatri mantra. Brihaspati offered the sacred thread, and Kashyapa Muni offered a straw belt. In other words, they're giving gifts. It's like when you have a birthday party, everybody gives some type of a gift. So these are very appropriate gifts for a brahmachari. Mother Earth gave him a deer skin, and the demigod of the moon, who is the king of the forest, gave him a Brahma Danda, the rod of a brahmachari. His mother, Aditi, gave him cloth for underwear, and the deity presiding over the heavenly kingdom offered him an umbrella. Who is the deity presiding over the heavenly kingdom? Indra, yes. O king, Lord Brahma offered a water pot to the inexhaustible Supreme Personality of Godhead. The seven sages offered him kusha grass, and Mother Sarasvati gave him a string of Rudraksha beads. When Vamanadev had thus been given the sacred thread, Kuvera, king of the Yakshas, gave him a pot for begging alms, and Mother Bhagavati, the wife of Lord Shiva, and most chaste mother of the entire universe, gave him his first alms. Having thus been welcomed by everyone, Lord Vamanadev, the best of brahmacharis, exhibited his Brahman effulgence. Thus, he surpassed in beauty that entire assembly which was filled with great saintly Brahmins. So it's obvious that he wants everyone to know who he is. Krishna did the same thing when he appeared before Mother Devaki and Vasudev. He came out fully clothed and with four arms, holding a club, a disc, a lotus, and a conch shell. And he wanted to know who he was, that he was the Supreme Lord. And therefore he manifested his effulgence. Quite often Krishna, as we see, withholds or withdraws that effulgence so that pastimes can go on and no one should think that he is the Supreme Lord. But when the Lord wants, he wants persons to know who he is and to recognize that he is an illustrious personality, then he manifests this incredible effulgence which can eclipse even the numerous suns. In fact, a little later on we will see when Vamanadev enters the sacrificial arena of Bali Maharaj, he enters with this effulgence just all around him. It's a radiation. And everything stops and everyone looks, wondering who this is. Some of the Brahmins are having little disputes. Could it be this person? Could it be that person? Is it the sun god? And so forth. So he does this for a very definite reason. And at this point, nobody actually knows who he is. When I say at this point, I mean the point when he enters the arena, which we haven't come to yet. Now go to the next verse. After Lord Sri Vamanadeva set a sacrificial fire, he offered worship and performed a fire sacrifice on the sacrificial field. When the Lord heard that Bali Maharaj was performing Ashvamedha sacrifice, that's a horse sacrifice, under the patronage of Brahmins belonging to the Bhrigu dynasty, the Supreme Lord, who is full in every respect, proceeded there to show his mercy to Bali Maharaj. By his weight, he pushed down the earth with every step. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is Akhila Sada Samvritta. In other words, he is the proprietor of everything essential in this material world. Thus, although the Lord was going to Bali Maharaj to beg something, he is always complete and has nothing to beg from anyone. Indeed, he is so powerful that in his full opulence, he pressed down the surface of the earth at every step. There was another famous person who did something like that. Does anybody remember the pastime? Yes, Dhruva Maharaj. He became filled with the potency of the Supreme Lord. When he stepped down, again, the earth kind of sunk in. Translation. While engaged in performing the sacrifice in the field known as Bhrigu Kacha on the northern bank of the Narmada River, the Brahminical priests, the descendants of Bhrigu, saw Vamanadeva to be like the sun rising nearby. So you can just imagine this little diminutive brahmachari is walking and light is all around him, can hardly see his face, and everyone is really amazed. O King, because of Vamanadeva's bright effulgence, the priests, along with Bali Maharaj and all the members of the assembly, were robbed of their splendor. Thus they began to ask one another whether the sun god himself, Sanat Kumara, or the fire god, had personally come to see the sacrificial ceremony. While the priests of the Bhrigu dynasty and their disciples talked and argued in various ways, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vamanadeva, holding in his hand the rod, the umbrella, and the water pot full of water, entered the arena of the Ashvamedha sacrifice. Appearing as a Brahmin boy, wearing a belt of straw, a sacred thread, an upper garment of deer skin, and matted locks of hair, Lord Vamanadeva entered the arena of sacrifice. His brilliant effulgence diminished the brilliance of all the priests and their disciples, who thus stood from their seats and welcomed the Lord properly by offering obeisances. Bali Maharaj, jubilant at seeing Lord Vamanadeva, whose beautiful limbs contributed equally to the beauty of his entire body, offered him a seat with a great satisfaction. Thus offering a proper reception to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is always beautiful to the liberated souls, Bali Maharaj worshipped him by washing his lotus feet. Lord Shiva, the best of demigods, who carries on his forehead the emblem of the moon, receives on his head with great devotion the Ganges water emanating from the toe of Vishnu. Being aware of religious principles, Bali Maharaj knew this. Consequently, following in the footsteps of Lord Shiva, he also placed on his head the water that had washed the Lord's lotus feet. Lord Shiva is known as Gangadhar, or one who carries the water of the Ganges on his head. On Lord Shiva's forehead is the emblem of the half moon. This is purport, by the way. Yet to give supreme respect to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Shiva placed the water of the Ganges above this emblem. This example should be followed by everyone, or at least by every devotee. Because Lord Shiva is one of the Mahajans. Similarly, Maharaj Bali also later became a Mahajan. In fact, this incident is going to distinguish him to such a high degree that he becomes a Mahajan just from this particular situation that will evolve forthwith. The water of the Ganges is sanctified because it emanates from the toe of Lord Vishnu. Did I miss a line? Okay, what is the first word that I missed? Okay, thank you. Yeah, similarly, Maharaj Bali also later became a Mahajan. One Mahajan follows another Mahajan. Mahajan is a great authority on bhakti yoga. I should say great, among the greatest authorities. And by following the parampara system of Mahajan activities, one can become advanced in spiritual consciousness. The water of the Ganges is sanctified because it emanates from the toe of Lord Vishnu. Bali Maharaj washed the lotus feet of Vamanadeva, and the water with which he did so became equal to the Ganges. Bali Maharaj, who perfectly knew all the religious principles, therefore took the water on his head, following in the footsteps of Lord Shiva. And this would create a tremendous effect upon his heart, as I will speak about in a few moments. Omagyana timananda syagananjana shalakaya chakshur unmalitam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. Before I comment on this particular verse or the verses and purports, I'd like to just recap something, because I was wondering where that went. Okay, picture of Krishna. What has happened here? We just recently read about the churning of the ocean of milk, the nectar being produced from that, the demigods receiving that nectar from Mohini Murti, and after they received that, of course, they received physical immortality. And when the demons, who thought they would get at least a share of the nectar, but they were cheated out of it because they were unworthy of this, at least according to the Supreme Lord, a fight ensued. And from that fight, a brawl, and from that fight, it was almost a war. And however, at this point in time, the demigods, having Lord Vishnu on their side, were now awesome, powerful, very strong, and invincible. When you have the Lord on your side, who can defeat you? In fact, in that battle, the Lord himself fought. Does anybody remember who he killed, who was a very famous demon? Who? No. Who? Yes, Kalanemi. And he became who? Kamsa, yes. And Kamsa was, of course, the king of Mathura, and he was destined to be killed by Krishna eventually. So there was a big fight which took place, and the demigods won the fight. So the demons were ousted, the demons were worsted, the demons were reduced to virtual poverty. They had nothing, and they had to flee the scene, and the demigods were now on top. So now we have here, a very different situation. Let me continue that in that line, and we'll come to this. So what happened was that in that battle, there were many demons who were killed. Bali Maharaj was one of the demons who was killed, and some of his generals were killed. And the way he was resuscitated was through the agency or the help of Shukracharya, their priest, through the process of mantra. He knew a mantra, it was called the Sanjivani mantra, and he uttered that mantra, and he was able to bring Bali Maharaj back to life. And he brought back a number of other persons back to life. As long as their heads were not off, or their arms were not off, their legs were not off, and they had full body, full head, he brought them back to life. So when Bali Maharaj later heard this, and he wondered, by the way, this what I'm narrating now is from the it's from the 8th canto, 15th chapter. Because it's important to know this connection, because we're in the 18th chapter, but certain things preceded this. And so we tend to forget what preceded, and it seems like it's just coming out of nowhere. So what happened was that Bali Maharaj and all of the demons, they were dispossessed. All their power, all their accomplishments, all their acquirements were taken away. And the demigods then had them at that point. So Bali Maharaj was wondering how he could recover, how he could regain all these possessions that he had, all these planets that he had, all this power that he had. So he thought about it for a while, and he said, well, if this Shukracharya, he could bring me back to life, and he could bring all my men, back, most of my men back to life, then maybe he can help me to recover all the positions or the powers that I once had. So let me think about it. So the first thing he did is he took initiation from Shukracharya. Now, as we know in initiation, how does that verse go? The translation, Tadvidi Paripantainap. But can I have the English first few words? Huh? No, that's not the first. Yeah, first few words. Yeah, thank you. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. So that's exactly what Bali Maharaj does. He approaches Shukracharya, and he undertakes as a servant, as a disciple, to perform any kind of service that he was called upon to do. He took actually a position of a menial servant. Here is a person who owned the whole world, and I put quotes on the word own because Krishna owns everything, but he owned it, and here he is now playing the part of a menial servant to not only Shukracharya, who is the son and disciple of Bhrigu Muni, but to many of the Brahmins who were there, and he's treating them all as his senior, as his superior, as his greater. And they became very impressed by his loving service to them. Of course, it's conditional service. It's service with a motive. A motive in order to become more powerful or regain the power that he once had so that he could recover his lost kingdom. After a while, Shukracharya then asks him, and he said, I'm very impressed by your service to me, and I would like to render some service to you. What would you like? So he mentions to him that I would like to be able to recover the kingdoms that I once had. But right now I'm in a very depleted position, and that's impossible. So Shukracharya and all the Brahmins, they said, we will perform a ceremony for you, and in that ceremony, or from that ceremony, great power will be released to you. And that's exactly what they did. And out of the sacrificial fire came a beautiful chariot with four yellow horses, also two quivers of arrows with arrows that were invincible, and sword, and and a number, and also armor, which could not be penetrated. So he was given the goods that would enable him to not only fight a war, but win a war with the demigods. This is what he was given. And so the next thing was that Bali Maharaj, having all this power, next wanted to again win back his the positions. So what happened is that they went to Amaravati, which is the capital of Indra, and that is where the demigods, many of the demigods reside. And they approached it with a full force, full army, to fight and to conquer. So when they approached the palace, Indra, he went up on the top of the palace, and some of the other demigods went up on the top, and they looked down and they saw the fierceness, they saw the power, the force, and the eagerness to win this battle in Bali Maharaj's face. They also saw that he had such grim determination that just looking at him made them quiver and quail. So they went immediately to their own spiritual master, who is Brihaspati, and they said, Bali Maharaj, he looks so powerful now. It doesn't look like we can actually fight with him and win. What do we do? So he explained to them what had happened. And he said, at this point, Bali Maharaj is much more powerful than you or any of the other demigods. So the best thing for you to do is to flee the scene. In fact, disguise yourself so that they don't know even who you are. Because if they do, they will attack you. They'll fight you. So just get out of these planets and leave. And don't come back until such time that you will be notified. So that's exactly what happened. And that's so what happened is Bali Maharaj took over the post or took over the position that Indra had, and his men took over the positions of the sun god and the ocean god, and Varuna and Vayu and the different the Chandra, the different demigods, and took over their positions. And so the demigods were then, they were away from home, so to speak. And that's why Aditi, being rather lonely for her sons, and also feeling very depressed for her son's position. Every mother likes her son to be successful. So her sons had become, as we say in the English language today, they had become losers. So they were complete losers. They had no jobs. Yeah, they were unemployed. They had no jobs, and there was no hope at that point in time that they were going to be re-employed or get a better position. So that's why Aditi, she asked her husband Kashyapa Muni, how can I not only regain or recover my sons, how can I bring them back here so that I can have the wonderful family life that we once had, but how can I get them back their positions? So Kashyapa Muni said, the only way you can do that is you would have to have the Lord as your son. And if you have Krishna, if you have the Supreme Lord as your son, then he will have the power to be able to overcome the power of Bali. So she asked how to do this, and he explained the Payavrata ceremony, explained how to do this. And sometimes we think of women being physically inferior to men, that they're not as strong as men. But here we see a woman who uses her power, uses her her knowledge, and uses the understanding that her husband of her husband's ability to be able to achieve a goal that she herself physically couldn't achieve, but could achieve by performing a very, very rigorous set of disciplines. And she performs them all perfectly. And the result of performing those rituals is that Vamanadeva appears, as we see here in this particular part of the story. So Vamanadeva appears, he is the Supreme Lord, and this is also in the fulfillment of a promise that he made long, long ago in the earlier age, the Satya Yuga. And that promise that he made to, does anybody remember the name of the two persons who performed tremendous amount of austerities in order to get the Supreme Lord as their son? Anyway, the name was Prijni and Sutapa. Yes, so they performed for thousands of years. They exposed their bodies to the cold, to the heat, to the rain, the darkness, light, winds. They lived on leaves or berries. Whatever it took, whatever discipline, whatever austerity, whatever penance they had to perform. In other words, this was painful. This was not pleasurable. But they bore it because the Lord was worth bearing it for. When you love someone, you're willing to do anything in order to obtain that person. If it's persons you need to release them from something, then you do that. If you need to get something for them, then you do that. Whatever the pain, whatever the difficulty, whatever the trouble is, it's no trouble when you love a person, then you want to relieve them of some difficulty or you want to please them in some way. For example, a mother has a child and she endures a tremendous amount of austerity and suffering in raising the child in so many ways, especially at night, the child screams and yells and sometimes doesn't shut up and goes on and on. So so many other things, changing the child and preparing the meals for the child. There's so much to be done. One gives up his own personal freedom, personal sense pleasure, in order for that child to grow up in a normal and strong fashion. So here again, we have in this same situation where the woman, namely Aditi, she is willing to bear any and everything. And this is an instruction to all of us. If we love the Lord, or if we're trying to love the Lord, how much are we willing to sacrifice? How much are we willing to give up? How much discipline, difficulty, tribulation, trial, pressure, stress are we willing to bear to show, to prove that we actually love Him? That's the proof of our love. You do this, and you don't only, not only we do it, but we don't complain, and we welcome it as something blessed and beneficial. Ah, I have an opportunity to suffer a little for Krishna. I have been taking and taking and taking so many blessings and benedictions and graces for so long. Now I have a chance to, quote-unquote, pay back, give back something that... give back something as a way of saying thank you. Anybody can say thank you, thank you, thank you. You can even teach a parrot to say, thank you, thank you, thank you. He doesn't know what he's saying. It doesn't have any meaning. But when it's backed up or it's given teeth, when it's given substance, when it's given some very definite, troublesome, difficult actions, then it means something. It means something because it shows that the person really and truly loves the person, assuming that the tribulation, the trial, the difficulty, the austerity is being done out of love for the Lord. And when it is done out of love for the Lord, in this case, of course, Diti is doing it out of love for her children. And we understand that. But what I'm trying to do is to draw a parallel of how we should take the same attitude, but not for something material, but really for something spiritual, so that we can, in effect, show the Lord that we truly mean it. For example, when we have our Rath Yatra, we undergo so many difficulties, we stay up late sometimes, there's so many pressures and problems to get things done at a certain time, in a certain place. So there's nothing to complain about. Krishna is now giving us the opportunity because we've been saying, yes, I love you, Lord, I love you, Lord. But what does that mean if it doesn't have any backing? When He gives us some pressures or problems or strains or stresses, our position should be, thank you, Lord, for this opportunity for me to express true love. Not merely saying I love you, not merely saying thank you, but thanking you and loving you by bearing difficulty and strain, and not even taking any pride in this. Not even thinking that I'm doing anything for you, because what I am doing is insignificant and not even important in comparison to all that you have given to me. So when you put them on a scale, we've done nothing. Even though there's pain, there's suffering, there's trial, there's tribulation, there's pressures, there's problems. This is a marvelous, wonderful attitude. There's a very wonderful quote of Srimati Radharani, if I can really remember it. I didn't study it before the class. Can't remember it. So you get this age, you start losing it.
So anyway, but the essence of the quote was is that whatever you give me, whatever pains I have to suffer, that you give me, Krishna, I will not only welcome it, but I will relish it. I will consider it the best of best. That is my greatest happiness, to suffer any way that you might want me to. Of course, Krishna doesn't want her to suffer, but she's saying that if you do want me to suffer in any way, to do it because you want it, and to please you as a result, that will give me the greatest happiness. So that should be our position, that it doesn't matter. And so that's what we get to learn from Aditi's discipline, for her hardship, for what she's trying to achieve. That we as devotees, sometimes I hear devotees saying, well, you know, I'm doing so much service, and it seems to me I'm not even being recognized. Nobody's even thanking me. Why do you want to be thanked? You owe this to Krishna. You're in debt. You don't, if you're in debt, and you do something for me and you're in debt to me, I don't have to thank you. You have to thank me for having loaned you something or given you something. Just think about that. So the debt, the debtor does not the debtor should not be expecting to be thanked, to be glorified, to be honored, to be applauded. The debtor simply is a servant, and he's receiving tremendous, great amount of mercy. So, having received so much mercy from the Supreme Lord, we have to be thankful that he's giving us an opportunity to suffer a little, have a little trouble, a little difficulty, and develop some, what I would call, virtues through the act, number one. And number two, when we learn to, through austerity, learn to suffer, learn to take trouble, learn to take tribulation, and it becomes automatic. Automatic, I mean, that we do it often, so that when real problems hit us, and knock us, and throw us, it doesn't bother us, because we're used to difficulty. Instead of generally a person who's not used to it and is always crying for sense pleasure and sense gratification, when he gets a little difficulty, trial, tribulation, problem, why are you doing this to me, Krishna? I've been serving you. I've been loving you. Yeah, love. I've been loving you, serving you, and praying to you, and look what you're doing to me. This is completely wrong. It's a totally misunderstanding of these teachings. So Krishna gives us an opportunity. And when he gives us the opportunity to suffer a little for him, we should be jumping with joy. Not easy. But if we perform austerities on a regular basis, then what is the problem? There is no problem. It's a problem only when we are always comforting ourselves, conveniencing ourselves, looking for the soft, easy touch, looking for the soft cushion, looking always for the softness. If that's what our desire is, we're missing the point. It doesn't mean that you can't sit on a soft cushion. You can do that. But we should not become attached to these things. Because once we become attached to them and they're not there, then we become irritated. We become upset. We become excited. We become sometimes afflicted. Oh, I've got to sit on this hard floor, all the chair. Oh, look, they got two cushions here. He's sitting on three cushions. He won't even give me one. I see that. You know. Look around, though, that you've got three cushions. There may be somebody who doesn't have one, and he's maybe cursing you. So the important point is that get used to difficulties. We get up at 3, 4 in the morning. That's good. Sometimes I tell a person's outside, you know, we get up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. What? I said, yeah, 3, 4, what's the problem? I do it every day. If I had to do it, I'd drop dead during the day. I'd never be able to do any work. So there you are. This just is an example or a sample of what I've been talking about. Austerity is good for the soul. It's often called the wealth of the Brahmins. And the wealth of the Brahmins means that we're ready for whatever Krishna gives us. That is our love. That is our offering. That is our surrender. That is our sacrifice. That is what we give to him. And we don't even feel we're giving anything, because he is super worthy of it. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Bhagavatam ki jai. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.